Hello and welcome to the AgTech So What podcast, brought to you by the AgThentic Group. I'm Sarah Nolette. So you've just clicked on this episode about Coca-Cola, and you might be wondering, well, what does Coke have to do with AgTech and farming? Well, more than you may think. For one, the Coca-Cola company happens to be the largest commercial buyer of sugar globally. And while their high sugar drinks certainly haven't earned them any gold stars from nutritionists, we're interested in what the company's doing in terms of innovation and sustainable sourcing. Recently, Coke has launched multiple sustainability initiatives focused on growing practices for ingredients and packaging. And while they don't deal directly with farmers, the sheer scale and influence of the global company means it's inevitably going to impact supply chains and ultimately farming practices.
I totally understand that farmers will perceive the sustainability push as a pressure and as an additional burden, right? I mean, I totally get that. But I also think that if you take a step back and you look really at where a lot of the agricultural practices have developed over the last 50 or 60 years and where the future is, given our whole context is changing, right? Just look at the availability of water, look at climate change. It can't go on like this, right? I think we all know that.
That's Ulrika Sapiro, the Senior Director of Global Water Stewardship and Sustainable Agriculture at the Coca-Cola Company. Ulrika is based in Belgium, but responsible for projects all over the world. In this episode, we talk about the increasing involvement the company is having in agriculture, from a development program for orange growers in Brazil to a peer-reviewed production standard for sugarcane in Australia. Now, you might have some skepticism about one of the world's most well-known brands and their role in sustainability. Like, is it just talk, or even worse, like greenwashing? There certainly are marketing benefits for Coca-Cola, and Ulrika will talk about that. But there's also a shift in the way multinationals like Coca-Cola are thinking about and influencing agriculture and sustainability all along the supply chain. Hopefully, that's a key insight that you'll get from this conversation. But if you disagree, be sure to let us know. So first, let's properly meet Ulrika.
You might detect a slight twang in my accent. I'm German and I grew up in Germany. I've left 20 years ago already. So I grew up sort of in between sort of half town or urban environment and half nature. So between what happened in the week and what happens the weekend and the holidays was very different environments. And I think that's quite a nice metaphor as well for what reality is now in my role, which is about this bridging of really the goals of a multinational company and suppliers or farmers, people with completely different and businesses with completely different interests or perspectives. And so, you know, I wouldn't say that I've grown up on one side or the other. I'm in this bridging sort of situation. And I think that's it's a good ability to have, especially on sustainability, which is seeping really through all aspects of business, of life, of, you know, what we need to do and where we need to change as society. So
did you have a particular passion for farming or agriculture growing up? Or how did you, like, as a child or as a kid or thinking about a career, did you want to work in food and agriculture?
No, I had no idea. Actually, my real sort of passion point, if you can call it, and what I studied ultimately, which is sort of probably a manifestation of a certain passion at a time, was history and politics, right? So, I mean, really nothing to do with it. It's more of a personal, was a personal interest. And my rural half, I'd say, of my upbringing was really more to do with forests, actually, than with farming. So we had a cabin in the woods and a combination of forestry and orchards, stone fruit orchards that were sort of situated within the clearings of the forest, which for that region is a very traditional way of fruit growing. So actually, that I only learned actually in my current role, that looking back at it, to understand what the agricultural landscape was that I grew up in. I took it for granted it was the way it was. But getting that context was really just coming back to me very much later.
I love it. It's funny how those different, I guess, threads connect something that you've done your whole life and then you didn't realize that it was a certain way or a certain lens on it from a different vantage point. That happens a lot, I think. So tell me about your current role.
Right. So the last 3 years, nearly, I have been a global lead for strategy and programs and policy at the Coca-Cola Company for water stewardship and sustainable agriculture. So within our sustainability team in the corporate center, I lead those two topics as a subject matter expert. And of course, then on implementation with the functions that actually do have and hold the relationship. So either with technical, who hold the relationship with our bottling partners, or with procurement, who obviously work closely with the suppliers. So on the agricultural side in particular, I have a very close relationship with procurement and the teams that do supply engagement.
So you mentioned a bunch of topics there around social and environmental and risk. Tell me a little bit about how the Coca-Cola company is thinking about sustainability and maybe how that's changed. I feel like there's been a bit of a shift recently that it's really hit the mainstream. It isn't sort of this niche thing off to the side that we have to do, but I'd be curious your experience and how the company thinks about it.
So sustainability, I mean, on the highest level or the first principles is for us an opportunity to enable growth for the business in the long term, but also to manage our risks effectively, right? I mean, these are the basic principles of how we look at sustainability. And that then leads to really a look across the board of what sustainability means in the social, economic, and environmental side and how that relates to our business. We do regularly, of course, materiality assessments for our sustainability risks. And really and that is evolving, right? There are certain issues that come up all the time and every time you do a review, others that you know emerge. But by and large, as I mentioned, the issues that we're really focusing and prioritizing at the moment are definitely around environment, world without waste, so our packaging, sustainable packaging strategy, our climate policy, and we have a science-based climate target, agriculture and water, which are very closely connected, and water stewardship has been a very strong priority for the last decades, I would say. And then human rights and community empowerment are definitely the others on the social side, the big issues. Now, doesn't mean that this is all we do, but this is really where we put a lot of external and internal focus and attention to. So this is how we see it. And we have also what has perhaps shifted, and it's worthwhile mentioning, is that you will have heard that a lot of corporates talked about the need to define purpose for their business. And this led to a huge discussion in the company because a lot of the discussion, you know, the opinions about this purpose was how do we embed what we say about sustainability in what we do and who we are? And a bit discussion, you know, more to the sense of why do we need this? We've done sustainability and these different aspects for a long, long time. Why do we need this now in a purpose? But in the end, actually, we had our leadership team and actually our CEO directly drafting our purpose statement, which was just launched a year ago, and says broadly that our purpose is about refreshing the world and making a difference. And we do that by producing love brands done sustainably for a better shared future. And it's very simple words, a few sentences, but it actually has helped us hugely to anchor decision-making and prioritization through COVID and this whole last year to say, okay, if this is our purpose, if this is the North Star, then logically certain decisions have to be taken in a certain way. And so I think it clarified a lot.
What's an example of that? Like, tell me how that's kind of playing out or what decisions an example of how that might look.
Yeah. So for example, I mean, one of the first things, of course, is about how do we react directly to the pandemic crisis in terms of, you know, keeping our employees safe, stepping over all the lines to work with our bottlers and making sure their employees are safe, engaging with our suppliers as well to offer support and assistance and manage those relationships first and foremost with an interest on safety of employees, but then very quickly shifting towards the idea of our purpose, a better shared future. I think overall, the first half of this year, we invested about $120 million across the foundation and the business in just community support. And that was anything from productive equipment to sanitizing equipment to supporting community groups to commercial support to small businesses, all the way to providing hygiene and hand washing facilities.
One of the comments that we get from listeners, especially when we talk to larger companies in food and ag, is sometimes like, oh, this is just marketing BS. Like they're just greenwashing and they don't really care. And it's, you know, something they do on the side. It's not really baked into who they are. And so I guess I'm curious what your response to that would be.
Yeah, I mean, the first response is I do understand the skepticism, especially from a, you know, huge global brand, consumer brand, that you would think that way. But if that was true, then we would have done much more marketing about it. And frankly, we haven't at all. We've done our thing. We're transparent about it. You can look at our website and we have really clearly listed out our actions and examples, but we haven't turned that into marketing spiel. So actually, much to the contrary, we also stopped essentially all our external marketing spend in the first quarter down into the second quarter of this year and reinvested a good part of that money into that community support.
One of the other things that gets talked about is that sustainability is this sort of burden that's getting pushed onto producers or onto farmers, and especially with smallholder farmers that maybe have less capacity to respond. But you were talking about partnerships and communities. So maybe talk a little bit about what you're doing that's producer facing, like what's the trade-off between opportunities versus burdens and kind of how that's benefiting producers.
Yeah. That's a very good question. Of course, it's the ultimate conundrum that we face in sustainability, in particular with regards to agriculture, because of course the distance in reality or in daily operating environment between a multinational that is ultimately using the product at the farmer, who is a very different environment, is just so stark, right? So these worlds are so different. But I think that a couple of things I need to probably get to this question. The first is, I totally understand that farmers will perceive the sustainability push as a pressure and as an additional burden, right? I mean, I totally get that. But I also think that if you take a step back and you look really at where a lot of the agricultural practices have developed over the last 50 or 60 years and where the future is, given our whole context is changing, right? Just look at the availability of water, look at climate change. It can't go on like this, right? I think we all know that. That's the first thing. The second thing is it actually isn't in the interest of farmers to continue operating often in the way they do. And again, there is not one farmer. There are so many different farm structures, so many different markets. There is not one solution and one problem. But overall, we haven't found a way to actually integrate in our thinking about finances and economics around farming all the externalities that are being produced or impacted. And if we were to be honest in quantifying all those impacts, we probably would have a very different look at the productivity or the value that is generated. And only if we can do that, then I guess then we will have a different view of what sustainability practices do. So that's just a starting point that I say. I do understand the pressure and the feeling of burden, but I also think we need to get over this because we know it's not going to continue like that. The other thing I need to say about the Coca-Cola company's particular specific role is I need to caveat that with sort of explaining a little bit where we sit in the supply chain and how we're organized, right? Because again, there is not one farmer, there is not one company. Not all food and beverage manufacturers are organized the same way of what they buy and where they buy it and how they procure it. And in our case, Coca-Cola is, of course, given the name, obviously, is most associated with its main consumer brand, Coca-Cola. But we have developed into a very diversified beverage company, right? We do not only sparkling soft drinks, we do juice drinks, juices, we have plant-based drinks, we have coffee, we have teas, we have dairy most recently added to the portfolio. So really a wide variety of products. And so if we are diversifying what we sell, we're obviously also diversifying what we buy. So quite a raft of different ingredients. But I say ingredients because we don't buy agricultural raw materials. We don't buy the commodities directly. We do buy processed, refined ingredients from processes. So we have certainly at least one, if not several, intermediaries in the supply chain. And we don't hold a direct relationship with farmers by and large. Again, this is changing as the business is changing. There are shorter and longer supply chains, but by and large, we don't have the direct relationship with the farmers. So our lever in engaging on agriculture is through the suppliers and building the relationship and the common understanding with the suppliers and then leverage that to make scale at the farm level.
There are two ways, at least, that the Coca-Cola company engages with their upstream supply chain to influence practices and outcomes on farm.
There are two tracks to it, very practically speaking. One is, given what I just said and where we are, we work quite heavily through standards and compliance with voluntary sustainability standards, which is a way for us to get some visibility on what's happening on a farm that is not directly connected to our business. And secondly, through targeted and very specific highlight, lighthouse, or demonstration projects at farm level, where we actually work with the suppliers to say, we have an issue, we have a region, we have a commodity or a particular ingredient we buy, we want to engage and we want to see how we can really shift the practices from where they are today to what is important to us. Again, to manage risks, but also to enable the growth.
Coca-Cola still has a long way to go before it can say that all of its ingredients are sustainably sourced. In their latest figures from 2019, they say that 54% of priority ingredients were sourced sustainably. But it's a huge task when you think about how many countries and locations they're sourcing from. Ulrika says that's part of the reason each sustainability project looks different. A recent example is a project in Brazil. To help improve the farming practices of smallholder orange growers, they've partnered with Cutrale, Coca-Cola's largest orange juice supplier in Brazil.
We buy an awful lot of orange juice in Brazil. I mean, Brazil is the orange juice producing market for the world, first thing. Second thing is we are a large buyer of orange juice and have a very close relationship with Cutrale. And thirdly, the orange juice sector in Brazil has made huge progress on sustainability and really managing their challenges, but it's really divided into the large farms that actually can manage a lot of their challenges, including greening and new pests that are coming, and the smallholder farmers who are in a much more precarious situation. And given that they are in a precarious situation economically and from a productivity and long-term yield perspective, that also leads then to deteriorating or not to standard practices on other things like human rights, like labor, like pest management, etc. So whilst we know that when we work with Cutrale through their own farms or the big farms on compliance with sustainability standards, we know that is taken care of because they have the capability and they are achieving really very high standards. We know that the smallholder farmers are in a different position. That's what this project is trying to really tackle, is to say, can we work with, and in this case with 480, that's the target smallholder, so smaller than 50 hectares of groves, orange farmers, to first understand what their challenges are, what their gap is towards achieving sustainability standards that we would accept as in line with our requirements, and really get to the root causes of those and set up a program supported by technology, technical assistance, I mean, the whole package essentially, to get them towards making progress in that direction, but in a way that is interesting to them. And of course, the first way of making it interesting is to make the farm viable and making the economics work.
Yeah, the phrase that comes to mind there that I hear often in agriculture is, if you're profitable, you can consider being green. But if you're not profitable, like, there's just no kind of green sustainability on the table. You're just struggling to survive, basically. And I'm imagining a farmer listening to this and saying, these sustainability programs, you know, great, but it's sort of a burden on me. And so what's the incentive for me to participate in one of these programs, or to think about certifications or third-party standards or changing practices even? How do you guys think about balancing the need for this and the genuine desire to help growers with the fact that it is, whether financially or psychologically, difficult to actually change what they're doing?
Yeah. So, I mean, I do, again, I caveat what I say, that I come and look at this from a completely different part of the supply chain, or of the whole chain of command that is going on, and looking at it from the outside. But there is this argument, indeed, that, you know, the farm has to make money, and then it can look into sustainability. The more I see the evidence, and particular now again, as we look into baselining or assessing where the farmers are in the beginning of such projects, you actually start to wonder, is it that they are not economically sustainable because they're economically viable because they're not sustainable? Because their practices are such that actually, it doesn't make sense economically, ultimately, either. So let me give you an example. If a farm is gotten into a position where basically it is just a monoculture and the entire landscape is just the same rootstock and canopy of orange juice, all the same varieties, of course, it is much more prone to capture pests, in particular as the general pest level and vectors are increasing. If you then add that sort of overuse of pesticides that is killing also natural, you know, predators of pests. These are all practices that we would call, you know, sustainability practices. But actually, at the end of the day, it is impacting your productivity because you are much more pest prone. It increases your base costs because you use much more pesticides and agrochemicals. And so, you know, it is actually the unsustainable practices that make you not being economically viable rather than the other way around. And what we need to try to find together is the starting point to turn a vicious cycle into a virtuous cycle and say, what is the first thing that we can do to turn around to actually start turning the wheel the other direction? And I guess costs and input costs and how we think holistically about how we're reducing those is one of them. but it's also about basic business acumen and skills, right? Do you know your costs? Have you understood where you're actually spending your money? Some of those basics, if you start identifying them cleverly and help farmers to move around, I think then you are in a different place. The challenge is finding that point and probably incentivizing and funding the initial turnaround and adaptation time. It's not about the long-term sustainability benefits. I think that by now is pretty much understood. It's this sort of initial turnover time that you need, of 4 or 5 years, I suppose, depending, that you need to cover.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I actually did work in my master's on transition to organic farming, looking at smallholder farmers in India growing wheat. And what we found was this sort of, exactly like you're saying, a worse before better. And so then the interesting kind of system design principle is, how do you cover the worse before better to incentivize that transition? And it's not just the cost, like you could sort of say, look, here's what it will look like and here's the money. But it's actually also about the psychology of what if it doesn't work? What if the worse is worse? Like, this whole better part is so uncertain. It's different behaviors, different practices. So that psychological part, I think, is actually almost as hard, if not harder, than the financial part in terms of that transition.
That's absolutely right. And it's I think it leads then to another aspect, which is such projects usually only last 3 to 4 years, right? And then you move on to something else. But to have actual behavior change takes so much more, just longer. So as soon as I often see that as soon as the first challenge hits, farmers or anyone, yeah, I'm not making it particular to farmers, this is a natural behavior, you reverse back to what you know, what you've done 20 years before. Just because you've done something different for 2.5 years is, you know, it's not enough embedded and ingrained, and you're not having the confidence. So the other challenge is to make it go last longer. And I think there's a question about, you know, how can you embed ongoing technical assistance, how you can embed ongoing coaching to farmers into, you know, the legacy of a project, so that they're not just left on their own and fight for themselves after you've decided the transition time is over.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess that it strikes me that the, you know, you guys as a company are really at the consumer side, understanding what consumers want and where those drivers are coming from. But as you were describing, like, you don't really have control of shifting the system necessarily. You've got incentives and you've got connections and you've got a stick or a carrot I'm sure you can wield, but it's not like you can snap your fingers and grow something differently tomorrow, because you'd actually do the growing. So it seems to me that there's then an incentive to sort of get closer to the producers, and whether that's through partnerships or more vertical integration. You mentioned different kinds of supply chains, but I'm curious, is my intuition there correct?
Well, certainly these projects is part of that growing, better understanding. I think for us, it's also about growing an understanding and embedding that understanding about farmer realities into our way of thinking, right? This is, as you say, we are a consumer marketing company to 99.5% of the business. So, you know, getting people to think differently about that part by having in mind what the beginning of the supply chain looks like, in particular raw materials, is part of that sort of just psychological mindset shift that we have to take. And so these projects are part of that, is helping the understanding, but also giving our weight, our name, our volume as well, right? And we are buying each amount of volume into the topic and the interest, and really our commitment to sustainability and making that case. I think there is that role that we have as well, as a convener, as a promoter, as a communicator. I think I wouldn't underestimate that. But I'd also say that I've seen an awful lot of change and positive change in these intermediate supply chains. So certainly not the impression that I want to make, that we go now and we just jump right to the front, let's say, of the queue, and say we go speak directly to farmers, and that's not our, it's actually not, it's neither our role nor is this the most effective way of doing things. I see increasingly that we've, over the past years, had our suppliers really pick up on the sustainability agenda and really actually owning it and actually leading it by themselves, right? And that's the right place, I think, for us to make the influence, not only stick and carrot, but actually the influence and the ownership of a sustainability agenda, and having a greater understanding of the benefits within the supply chain with suppliers to actually own it. And we've seen a huge uptake, and that's why partnering with suppliers like Cutrale in Brazil, or in, you know, of course, also in Australia, or on sugarcane in India, is so important, because you actually embed and partner together on this. The second area that I see is really changing is that more and more brand manufacturers like us, and it's been going on now for the last 10 years, do understand that agriculture is a pre-competitive area, actually, because we don't have dedicated supply chains by and large, right? We all share the landscapes in a way. And so this pre-competitive collaboration on sustainable ag is really picked up a lot. And I see this as a positive opportunity as well, because that reduces the noise for the farmers and gets us a bit more focused.
I wanted to go back to the point you made about being a consumer, you know, brand marketing company. Are there ever examples of requests coming from internally that are just totally unrealistic because people don't understand agriculture? You know, someone saying, oh, we should run a, you know, a program to do this, or what if we could market this thing? Can we make the growers do that? Do you ever have to really bridge that divide?
Yes, of course. I mean, I've lived a few of those situations, and it's interesting. As you know, as a consumer company, the motto and really the strategy now to survive in the market and to be relevant is to be fast and customized, to be agile, to be, you know, quickly turning around things, to have a new product or variety of drink on the shelf within 3 months, ideally, right? So really be fast and really be responsive. And as a consumer, you take this for granted because you want something that you like now. And of course, right, why not? But to make that work all the way through the supply chain is just incredibly hard. So we had these discussions indeed about putting new products on the shelf within speed and record time. And I say, well, but the fruit isn't grown and the fruit isn't harvested. It's not there, right? You have these absurd conversations where you sort of have between a marketing and an advertising plan and what that says and the reality of a field, a grove, and whether the juice is actually available.
Yeah, of course. I mean, and especially as we get more disconnected as a society from where our food comes from. Like, we already see that now. We want blueberries all year round and we want apples all year round. And like, those things don't grow all year. So then we have to ship them, but then people don't want food miles. And so, yeah, it's quite an interesting challenge. You mentioned some work in Australia. I'm interested because of the differences in interventions or programs in developing countries versus more developed countries like Australia. Do you want to tell me about that example and how you guys think about operating differently in a more developed country?
Yeah, absolutely. So in Australia, just as context, if I look at the global map and of our sort of engagement around sustainable agriculture projects, I have a few sort of real hotspots because they're really interesting things. And Australia is one of them. And it's in sugarcane with sugarcane growers in Queensland. But the reason why I particularly like the work in Australia is that it actually wasn't designed as an agriculture project as such. It was actually designed or started as a water and water replenishment and water protection project, but through the lens of agriculture. And I think it's been one of the pilot projects that then led globally to a number more water projects that were really targeted around agriculture communities and farming practices to actually help alleviate sort of bigger watershed problems and stresses. So it's been a real pioneer in that sense. It also came a bit left field. So now we're talking about it as an agriculture project, but actually it was a water project. And the other thing I really like about it is that it's been one of the real sort of long-term commitments. And you can see what you can achieve if you commit and you really engage over the long term. So this is now 12 years, been set up in 2008 with our sort of water and conservation partner WWF in Australia. And we've continued that conversation, that project over the years. It grew more stakeholders and more, of course, more farmers and growers into participating, from I think 19 in the beginning to 130. And the whole purpose was to work on innovative practices, but also technologies for sugarcane growers to reduce the pesticide runoff from the fields into the oceans and into damaging the Great Barrier Reef. That was really the core purpose. And then it developed sort of more and more into really farming and practices innovation, and to grow out, make the case, demonstrate it works, quantify what it really actually benefits, and then scale into more growing areas.
You mentioned that last piece of kind of quantify and make sure it works. I'm interested in, like, again, one of the kind of pushbacks or concerns is there's no scientific evidence for this. Again, it's just greenwashing, or it's something a big brand wants to say that they're doing, but the science actually isn't solid. So tell me a little bit about that kind of quantification verification piece.
Yeah. And again, there are two angles to this. So we came to the whole water replenishment, or the whole reason starting doing such projects, through the realization that, of course, we are a beverage company and we use obviously a lot of water for our production, but we also need good quality water. So we have a global operating footprint. We're pretty much bottling in on the ground in nearly all countries of the world and territories. So wherever we are, we need the water, we need good quality water. And the idea was, or this was the goal and the vision at the time was, is there a way that we can actually give back to nature and communities the equivalent amount of the water that we actually take for our business, to sort of, yeah, really reverse the flow and say we invest into capturing, storing, making available, cleaning up water that otherwise would have been lost and wasn't available for nature and communities to the same tune. And in a way, it's just a metric, right, to say we are using X amount of water, so we're doing the same, which is sort of from a business accounting perspective, a logical metric to take. I mean, it's very ambitious because we said global volumes, not just volumes in Australia, but globally. But that was the starting point. And we know that we are under heightened scrutiny as Cokes. It's not the first time that we would be criticized. And so we take a lot of care and effort to underpin the work with a very solid methodology. So really go scientific. It's been peer reviewed. It's been published, of course. So there is for all major types of programs or projects that you could generate positive volumetric water benefits with, be it, you know, a storage, a wetland, reforestation, soil management, irrigation technologies, you know, all major sort of possibilities that we've actually have in our global portfolio project. We have a methodology that specifically addresses how do you quantify in a meaningful way the volumetric benefits. And that methodology is now actually not only ours, not proprietary, but since last year, it's now open source. So there's been a whole consortium of organizations that looked at this and looked at other methodologies and actually came up with a common framework for quantifying volumetric benefits. And that's what we're transitioning into now as well. So, I mean, it is really sound, and we're very transparent about how we get to those numbers and what we do getting there.
A next step for Coca-Cola will be looking at how to quantify natural capital to measure some of the other benefits, such as carbon storage, that come with certain practices. But this phase is super complex, and it's still only early days in terms of evidence for what actually works.
It goes both ways, right? I mean, if you have certain effects or impacts or uses, and they are not quantified or financially valued, that neither is a price nor is there a capital to be gotten, right? So the natural capital is the other side of the coin. And yeah, that applies to, in particular now with the whole carbon and climate discussion, it's an interesting dynamic to look at this again, because it's not a new concept, the idea of quantifying externalities or natural capital. It's been around for some time, but it gets a new, I think, new traction now, which is interesting. And I'd say it is a debate for both sides, right? You've got to find a sort of a market for the impacts and for the benefits. And I currently am working quite a lot with our business, but also with external stakeholders on looking again, particularly at the co-benefits, the externalities, if you like, of these replenishment projects that we're just talking about. And there's quite a huge opportunity in those, because most of them are nature-based solutions. And we know that nature-based solutions do yield a lot of carbon sequestration benefits in general. So there's a huge opportunity to get to the more natural capital positive side of the coin, which I think is a great incentive if we can make it marketable, if you like, to get more investment into this area.
I agree. There's sort of this resurgence around natural capital, that it's not a new term. And I think there's a bunch of people, probably yourself included, sort of sitting there going, we've been talking about this for 20 years. Like, why are all you guys talking about it now? And why is it suddenly so sexy? But like, we've been trying to do this for decades now. Like, what's going on? Do you have any sense of like what's driving that?
Well, there's this wonderful saying, right? There's nothing more powerful than a good idea whose time has come. And we've had this in small ways and in big ways, that, you know, you had an idea and you have pushed a project or a new innovation, and it just wasn't, that your surrounding wasn't ready yet. And I think this is the same with the idea of true cost or full cost accounting and natural capital. There just hasn't been the enabling environment, including the political environment, to receive it. And now, in the wake of the Paris Agreement, in the wake of science-based climate targets, so there's actually a clear goal that has been set that has metrics that you need to achieve, suddenly you have in a receiving environment. But yeah, whenever we're failing with an idea, just remember you know, it's probably not the right timing yet. Just wait another few years.
Yeah, I'm sure that seems easy in hindsight, but it's hard at the time when you're passionate about something. You mentioned a couple times technology and innovation. Some of these things are changing also because the technologies that can enable this to happen, whether it's transparency or digitizing some of these supply chain incentives or new pesticides or biological solutions for growers, like that just didn't used to exist. How does technology play a role in some of these sustainability initiatives?
Yeah, interesting. So innovation and technology, or technology being a particular form of innovation, right? I seem to be coming across here as a bit of a skeptical mind, but I often also see this as the sort of the bling of innovation is the technologies, the new gadgets, you know what, and it's super exciting and it's inspiring. And I really wouldn't want to miss it because it really gives you the sort of the futuristic feeling. But there is a tendency, and this is not unique to agriculture. It's I think it's general, again, human behavior that you like the shiny new objects more than the drudgery of just the basics. But having said that, so yes, absolutely. That is something that we are very much engaged in across all our sustainability areas. And we have been actually on the forefront for the things that are core to our business, either product innovation or packaging innovation, the forefront of leading and supporting new ideas and new solutions. And some of them worked. And some of them didn't, and you just keep going, right? And so that's the same with, as we're engaging in agriculture farming projects like the ones we talked about, Brazil or also Australia, we try to use technology and test technology in that local context as much as possible, be it applications to engage farmers and to baseline what they do and then give them a scorecard and then directly technical assistance, or as in the case of Australia, you know, drones and very specific pest management and sensing technology. But I think what this also, I think, tells me generally is that innovation and technology is dependent on the context in which it's sort of actually used. And often, depending on where you start, something very simple that you wouldn't identify as innovation today is actually super helpful and very innovative. So example, sugarcane smallholder farmers in India, just had another big project there. Just having a tractor or just some machinery or some simple laser leveler that helps them to sort of laser level their field is such a huge innovation, such a huge step forward. From our perspective, perhaps in Australia or Europe, that's not nothing new, obviously something new, but there it is absolutely what's needed. So innovation is really dependent on the context and the farming structure, of course, and that's, I think, one of the lessons. But I think going back to a point you made earlier as well, Sarah, innovation nowadays is a lot about psychology and behavior as well. And that has to do with how do we engage? How do we reach out? How do we keep farmers on the journey, turning around that wheel into the positive direction, to the virtuous cycle, and keep going at that? And I think I see not enough innovation in that sense, sort of more in the psychology and the behavior change and the engagement, which I think will be hugely important.
Yeah. And I really like what you said about open source. Like, it's one thing to sort of do this to convene, and then it's another thing to say, and we'll share this knowledge, like others can do it, come access the protocol or peer reviewed science and implement it yourself. I think that's kind of the next step there as well. You mentioned before sort of things that didn't work, or innovations that you've tried that haven't worked. Are there any examples of that come to mind? I always love technology failure stories.
Let me quickly think. I mean, I like them too. There are a lot of learning, but it takes courage to admit to them in public. Well, I guess there's certainly a very dynamic innovation area in the packaging space, because that, of course, is such a huge issue. And there are different schools of thought and activities. One is about, can we innovate our way out of the problem, or do we have to go through the drudgery of trying to make the circular economy work? And what does this mean? So on the innovation side, of course, there are really, really impressive sort of innovations around new recycling technologies, which do work sometimes, but in particular when you need the recycled product for food grade material to put new food into it, you have to have a very, very high level of confidence and cleanliness and purity. And often these new technologies can't deliver that, or not yet. Again, perhaps the time hasn't come yet and it takes a little bit more, or alternative sources of packaging, but then they fall apart, or they don't hold the oxygen or the carbon dioxide or whatever. So it's important that you push your innovation, you find new solutions, but more often you might not actually have it commercialized or used for what you originally thought. There is actually perhaps a completely different route of what you do with it.
Waste management, and packaging especially, is an area Coca-Cola is quite active in. But here again, the challenges are complex and involve both behavior change and tech or science-based innovations. For example, even though we can recycle bottles right now, we of course don't always do so. So Coke has to weigh up whether to work at the beginning of life, such as materials that go into packaging, or at the end of life, as in how we collect and reuse what would otherwise be waste.
We have coined our sort of goals and vision as a world without waste, which we want to achieve by 2030, which means we want to go for our packaging entirely circular. And that has different elements to it. But of course, there's a recycling and recycling technology collection, as you say, how do you engage on infrastructure for collection? How do you build that? And how do you get consumers to actually use it is a huge challenge. How do you bring it back? And how do you innovate as well and design recyclability into your packaging? And we're nearly 100% recyclable in the packaging. But how do you get recycled content back in? But in addition to that, again, the ultimate question, are there other ways of getting to packaging material, right? That is not perhaps fossil fuel based. And we've been active in that area for a long time. We launched back in 2009, so more than 10 years ago, Plant Bottle, which is basically a bio-based PET, so it's still a PET in the end, but it comes partly from bio-based material, at the time, particular sugarcane molasses and sugarcane products, and it had a huge run in North America and in Europe and other parts of the world. But at the end of the day, the issue of waste management, so end of life, was so much more overpowering and important for us to fix and for society to fix than the beginning of life, which is the source of the packaging material. So we really shifted our priorities towards collection and recycling, because that's where the real challenge is. But on the other side, you see new things like heel clip, which is essentially secondary packaging. So to keep a six pack of cans together, in the classic sense, you always put a shrink wrap of plastics around it, you know, just to take it off the shelf in the supermarket more easily and put it into your trolley. And to replace that shrink wrap, this plastic wrap around it, with basically a paper-based or cardboard-based holder at the top. So to click those cans in and to basically have your hold together secondary packaging from cardboard material, which is FSC and sustainably sourced. And that takes away some of the plastics, of course, and it's easier recyclable. Again, for consumers, it's often easier to put a piece of that cardboard together with your newspaper into your bag rather than think about what to do with your shrink wrap. So it helps perhaps as well to support consumer behavior.
Yeah, and taps into that psychological kind of behavior change factor too. When you think about where we are now and some of those conversations we're having today that isn't the right time, if we were going to do a podcast in, I don't know, 10 years, what do you think we'll be talking about then in terms of technology and sustainability?
Wow. You could have briefed me on that question. I would have thought of that.
It would have been way less fun.
That's right. You know, and again, I look back to look forward very often. And, you know, in the sustainability sort of profession, it's been the sort of saying that, so 10 years ago, in 10 or 15 years, we will have, you know, solved everything and we'll be out of a job. That will be the objective, to be out of a job as a sustainability professional. And I really believe that. I really thought, okay, particularly 2020, ironically, was supposed to be such a sustainable year because we had so many strategies and so many targets that would end in 2020. We were so happy. And then we're here and we see that actually the mountain we have to climb is even higher, right? And looking at 2030 as a pivotal year for sustainable development goals, for the Paris Agreement, for fixing the climate, or at least slowing climate change, what we need to be talking about is how we actually made sustainability a core economic and financial language or currency in economic speak, and in our, not only in the corporate environment and how we actually as companies measure our success, but also as societies, is to find a way to integrate sustainability impacts into how we account for our, you know, value as a company and for our GDP and success as a society. That I think is for me the biggest innovation that we can do right now.
And that's it for another episode of AgTech So What, brought to you by the Agthentic Group. For links to information on any of the programs Ulrika mentioned, please visit agtechsowhat.com. Also, our venture capital firm, Tenacious Ventures, is hosting an event on February 10th for wholesale or sophisticated investors who are interested in ag tech. We'll be sharing trends, talking about our investment thesis, and you'll hear directly from three of our portfolio companies. We have limited space left before final close of the fund. If you're interested in ag tech and you're a wholesale or sophisticated investor, go to tenacious.vc/invest for more information and to register. Thanks, as always, for listening. And remember, if you like what you hear, please leave us a review wherever you're listening to this podcast. And please share the show with your friends and colleagues. I'm Sarah Nolette. Catch you next time.